and welcome to the House Energy and Environment Committee for February 20th. This is an continuation of an informational meeting from last week on the update on the proposed Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. We have testimony that we weren't able to hear last week, so we're going to finish that up today. Sorry about the wait. And first, we're going to have the Department, Water Resources Department, and the Governor's Office come back up because there were a couple more questions that I had. And then we have Water Watch, Water for Life, and Pacific Core that were unable to testify last time because we ran out of time. So, Tom, question I had for you, I didn't know if you had finished all the information about the adjudication or if there was anything that you wanted to add before I asked a question about that.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Paul, Deputy Director of Oregon Water Resources Department. To start off with, I'll give you a real quick thumbnail of what we're doing, what an adjudication is. Oregon Water Law was adopted or became effective February 24th, 1909. We're nearing our 100th birthday. There was considerable water use occurring throughout the state as of that date. So the law recognized that and established a process where those folks using water prior to adoption of water law could claim a water right, justify what they had, and go through a process where a water right was actually granted to them. And that's exactly where we're at in the Klamath. But we started about 25 years ago, and the law says to go through this, you have to submit a claim to the Water Resources Department, and then the director or adjudicator in this case receives those claims, reviews them, determines the validity of the claim. Other water users in the basin can challenge or contest, file a contest to those claims, challenging, for example, priority date for irrigation, number of acres irrigated source, and any number of things. Through the adjudicator's efforts, then those claims are resolved, either through a contested case or through negotiated settlements between the parties. Once the adjudicator makes it through the filing of the claims, review of the claims, resolution of the contests, the adjudicator or director develop an order which is filed with the local circuit court, and it's actually the local circuit court then that issues a decree establishing what the various water rights are. Oregon Water Law is based on the doctrine of prior appropriation, which is the water right holder with the oldest date of priority gets to use the water the longest. And during times of shortage, folks with the more junior water rights are regulated off. Any basin, such as the Klamath, where the water rights have not been adjudicated, folks claiming water rights, such as irrigators, with a pre-1909 priority date, they may be claiming that date, but we cannot protect their priority date. We can't regulate to get them water during times of shortage. Once the adjudicator files the order with circuit court, according to the statute, then that does become the basis for our field folks to manage in favor of those senior priority dates. So it will be a change in the basin once we get to that point where senior water rights can be protected, where to date they have not been. At the last meeting, Representative Girard asked a question as to whether or not the settlement agreement would trump the adjudication process. And it does not. It does not trump, the adjudication process does not trump Oregon water law. I think I did mention last time that agreements such as the one we're talking about, plus the others that have been entered into, and there are a fair number of other agreements that we have to date to resolve the various contests. Those agreements are filed with the adjudicator, and the adjudicator then considers those for incorporation into the adjudication, into the order that he does file with the local circuit court. He isn't bound to adopt them. And agreements such as this do not grant water rights, do not resolve the claims. They may very well resolve the contests, because hopefully it's the parties that are challenging one another that are sitting down and coming to an agreement. So those contests go away. But as far as the final decision as to what the right will be, it's going to be up to the adjudicator and subsequently up to the circuit court.
Thanks for that clarification. And we're about 2 years away, I think, is what I had heard during the testimony earlier from the final adjudication. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, the adjudicator right now is projecting that the order will be filed, his order will be filed with Klamath County Circuit Court in approximately 2 years.
Okay. And then what does life look in the Klamath Basin look like post-adjudication? In other words, 25 years this process has been going on, and the outcome is going to be there'll be some winners, there'll be some losers.
Madam
there'll be some happy people, unhappy people. And how do we manage that process?
Madam Chair, as I mentioned, up until the time the order is filed with Circuit Court by the adjudicator, if a person claiming a priority date before 1909 contacts the water master and says, my water is not coming to me. I have an old water right, and I'm not getting what I think I deserve. The water master cannot respond to that because there is not a water right subject to regulation. And Oregon statute in the water law talks about what the water master can regulate for and against. And until the order is filed with circuit court, our water masters cannot respond to somebody who is just holding a claim. After the order is filed and probably continuing through until the decree is issued by circuit court, our water master and water masters, possibly, will be able to respond to those calls for water and will be able to regulate junior water right holders.
So, just to clarify, so the department is anticipating you'll need additional resources, and there will be some junior water right holders that will have access to the water right.
Madam Chair, that is correct. We are anticipating that this will result or may result in the regulation of junior water right holders to the benefit of those senior priority dates. We do have one water master that's down in the basin right now dealing with conflicts in the areas that have already been adjudicated, and there are some small areas that have been adjudicated, as well as those water rights that have been established by water right permit. We do think that it will take additional resources in the area to manage water for the benefit of those senior appropriators.
Okay. And also, so just to clarify, there was talk about the agreement, the restoration agreement, but I'm not clear that there was discussion about how that fits in with the adjudication, and I think Tom clarified that to some extent, that this is after the adjudication, an agreement that has been worked out with certain parties. Do you want to comment on that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sue Knapp, and I'm a policy advisor with the Governor's Natural Resources Office. To clarify that, the settlement agreement, or the restoration agreement, as Tom indicated, will be within that agreement. There are water rights contests that are resolved. And so the agreement itself will be offered to the adjudicator as a recommendation to resolve those water right contests. So it's simply a recommendation to the adjudicator. Does that answer your question?
Yes. And can you maybe talk a little bit about the different parties? I don't think that was clear also, and how I think there's 26, if I recall right, and how those 26 were contacted or included or involved, and was there any type of broader outreach? I'm not familiar with how it was initiated, so I think that would be helpful for the committee as well. And then we're going to hear from some of the parties I know who were not part of that, so we'll probably hear the different perspective.
Madam Chair, that's members of the committee, that's a good question to ask. There are 26 parties that finally came to terms or to an agreement with the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. They reflect a diversity of stakeholders within the basin, from water users, either on project and off project, tribal members amongst the four tribes in California and Oregon, states of California and Oregon, federal agencies, as well as a number of conservation groups, and commercial fishing. So those are the parties that were represented. As far as the initial selection of these parties, I can't really answer that because I'm not sure how they were selected. I was not part of the process at that time, although I do know that there was an effort to get as wide and diverse and broad a representation to this group as possible, considering the number of diverse issues and conflicts that were in the basin.
All right, thank you for that clarification, and we'll see if there's a few questions for this panel, if you can want to represent.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. And quickly, Tom, could you give me a sense statewide how common this problem is of senior water rights claimants who don't actually hold the right because they established it pre-water law? To what extent has the state been adjudicated, or to what extent is the Klamath situation potentially replicatable in other basins?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, approximately two-thirds of the state of Oregon has been adjudicated. Most of eastern Oregon, Klamath would be an exception. The Umpqua Basin has not been adjudicated down around Roseburg, and a majority of the Willamette Basin has not been adjudicated in the coastal area. Most of the adjudications have occurred because there was conflict between the claimants and subsequent water users, and they petitioned the either state engineer or water resources director to conduct the adjudication.
And follow up, Madam Chair, are we facing water shortages or the potential for conflict in any of those other cases?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, I will say yes, the potential is always there for that kind of conflict. The reason some basins have not been adjudicated, primarily coastal and Willamette, is because we see more water in those basins.
Also depends on the time of the year.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Representative Burley and Representative Bard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom, would you share with us, please, what's the existing authority the Oregon Water Resources Department has to enter into negotiations with federally recognized tribes over water rights?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Burley, in the case of the Klamath, we felt that the tribe did have to enter into the adjudication process. We were challenged on that and ended up going to the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, once or twice, I don't recall, but we have been to the Supreme Court and they did rule, yes, the tribes have to participate in the adjudication process. In, I believe it was about 1987, the legislature adopted specific language about entering into negotiations with Indian tribes to settle their claims on water rights. And immediately following that legislation, the department worked with the Warm Springs and the Deschutes and made it through that process, which resulted in the quantification of the Warm Springs claims. Those statutes are found in ORS 539-300 is where it starts, specific to the Water Resources Director sitting down with tribes to resolve that.
Thank you. But specifically, 539-100, et cetera, What are some of the conditions, though, of the authority? I mean, does it not say that such negotiations have to be open to the public with public notice and opportunity for input and all that?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, the 1987 legislation that was adopted does talk about negotiations with Indian tribes being open and noticed. And originally when that statute was adopted, it was adopted specific to the Warm Springs negotiations. In this case, the Klamath are entering into an adjudication process just like other claimants in the system. And we have been dealing with their claims the same as any other claimants. In the case of the negotiations that were and the settlement agreement that we're talking about here, that is our interest, of course, is to resolve the contests that have been between the tribe's claims and the contestants. Again, through this settlement agreement, we are not quantifying what the claims are. That's still up to the adjudicator to determine the elements of the claim, the priority date, the quantity of water, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, just quickly, and this is probably more going to be a comment, Tom, but it's my understanding, and you're right, 1987 was Senate Bill 137 that established, that was codified at 539-100. But then in 1993, House Bill 2109 was passed, and it took that authority, which was originally limited to the Warm Springs Reservation, and expanded to all federally recognized tribes. But, you know, my understanding and what I was trying to get at here is that my understanding is it's pretty specific as far as allowing individuals the right to file exceptions to the agreement once it's been filed and those types of things. And so my question really is, where I'm going with this is, you know, has that been the case as you've been negotiating and proceeding with this Klamath negotiations?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, in the case of the specific settlement agreement that we're talking about here, the structure that was established to where all of the interests to come up with a more global settlement agreement came up with a process, and that did have confidentiality in it as far as the elements until such time as the agreement was released. We're not viewing this process as violating the open process as you're describing that was adopted initially in 87, in part because we're not negotiating through this to quantify what the claims are of the tribe. Again, it is to resolve the contests, or part to resolve the contest between the tribal claims and those folks that were submitting the challenges.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Burris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's almost impossible, Tom, to discuss this whole restoration without being detailed. And I apologize for that, but probably one of the main issues in the agreement is water right enlargement. Would you explain for the benefit of the committee what that is and how it is one of the primary issues of this settlement?
Madam Chair, Representative Garrard, I'll step out of the adjudication process for a minute and talk about water right transfers, because that's really where we deal with enlargement. And if somebody is filing a transfer application to change an existing water right, we look at it, and I'll use irrigation as an example. If the originating right is for 10 acres and they submit a water right transfer and propose to irrigate 15 acres, that's enlargement. Or if they want to move the place of use, and the original 10 acres is still irrigated and the new 10 acres is going to be irrigated, that's enlargement, making the water right bigger. The other would be to end up with more water than what the original water right allowed. In this case, in the case of the settlement agreement, reading the agreement, draft agreement on its face, there is a reference to transferring or changing some water from project users to in-stream protections. And the way that could come about would be if the project dries up some land and transfers some water from project to in-stream. There is a legal process under law to do that. You could also get there by a water right lease to temporarily dry up some land and again put the water to a new use. There is a way to expand a water right somewhat legally, and that is through an allocation of conserved water where maybe the project identifies a conservation project that saves the water. Then they can file an application with us to capture that saved water and either spread it on new land or put it to a new use. So there are some legal mechanisms, but just to take water that is no longer used and apply it somewhere else or add it to another right someplace else, there is no legal process under Oregon water law to expand the water right in that way. I hope I kind of got to it. It is very technical, very complicated. Some folks are reading the agreement to say, because the project doesn't need all of the water, then there's the ability to grab the excess and protect it for a different use. And that would not be consistent with Oregon water law.
Madam Chair, thank you, Tom, for that last statement, because that basically is what the restoration agreement calls for, is to take, in essence, paper water rights, water that's never been used, and give it to somebody else. And you answered that question, and I thank you, saying it is not legal.
Okay. Representative Benz, you're welcome to the committee.
Yes, thank you very much for the invitation and allowing me to participate. Mr. Paul, I apologize for coming late to this discussion, and I hope this question hasn't been asked too many times before, but as you're approaching the end of your adjudication process, at what point will the department be able to give those interested parties some idea of how much regulation is estimated to have to occur? Are you getting closer to the point you're going to be able to do that, or is this going to be right up to the very end, and then we're suddenly going to learn who's going to be shut off and who isn't?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, I won't have a good sense of that until after the adjudicator prepares the order, because the order is going to have details as to the priority dates, the uses, the amount of use, and that sort of thing. We know about how much water is in the basin. You know, you can model that. You can look at gauge records to say how much is there. But until we know what the water right record is, it's really hard to estimate how much regulation will result, if any.
Thank you. And when will that be? Can you give us some guess?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, again, the adjudicator is projecting now that the order will be prepared and filed with Circuit Court in approximately 2 years.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions before we call up the remaining folks who'd like to testify? Okay, thank you. Stick around, there may be some other clarifications. Okay, next we're going to hear from Water for Life, and we have Andrew Roby, did I get that right? Bobby? And actually, I'm going to also call up a different viewpoint, Water Watch, and John DeVoe.
Can I invite up Lisa Brown of our office to potentially respond?
Sure. There's an extra seat. Andrew, why don't you get started and just make sure and state your name for the record, please.
Sure. My name is Andrea Robbie, and I'm a member of Water for Life. I'm also an Upper Basin irrigator. We have a ranch and a large animal vet clinic. And I have four kids that someday I hope can take over that ranch with water. So As Water for Life, we have a few concerns regarding the settlement as it stands. One, we've been given a pretty short time frame to respond. Up until January 15th, this was a confidential process. Now, once that became public, the draft settlement, we've had 30 to 45 days to comment. You know, we've heard a lot of complex issues listed here. There's a lot of questions that are coming up as we move forward with this discussion. And we'd really like to see some more time to be able to thoroughly look at the implications of this that could potentially affect us permanently and definitely for the next 50 years. You know, looking at some of the issues that have arisen, it doesn't seem that it's equitable between the upper basin and lower basin irrigators. We all have the same needs. We all need to see some ESA assurances. We all need to see water delivery assurances. And we all need to have equal access to affordable power. Unfortunately, the settlement doesn't seem to treat us equally. The upper basin irrigators seem to be giving up a lot and not receiving these assurances. The project irrigators have received some of these assurances, but at the same time, we would like to be able to continue negotiations to come to an agreement that works for everyone. The county commissioners in Klamath are proposing hosting talks between the three parties represented within the Klamath Basin. We have the on-project irrigators, the upper basin irrigators, and power users, and the tribes. That being the Klamath tribes that are specifically of interest there with our water adjudication. We would like to see some time to allow those parties to meet under the guidance and facilitation of the county commissioners to see if we can resolve those issues so that we have something we can move forward with that we can all support and all live under. We also have some questions concerning Oregon State water law. Some of the answers we heard earlier from Tom seems to clarify some of that, but at the same time, looking at the agreement, it says in 14.2 that the agreement must comply with Oregon water law, but yet if you look at some of the inconsistencies within the rest of the document, it's not quite clear how that's going to comply with Oregon water law. It seems to be conflicting. And so we just need some clarification there to make sure that all the aspects of it do comply with Oregon water law and not just the blanket statement that, yes, it will comply, but yet the actions don't show that compliance. Another big thing, we talked about the water adjudication. It's been ongoing since 1975. As being a contestant and a claimant in that adjudication, we've spent a lot of money on attorneys, and attorneys have come out ahead. The community seems to have suffered. We'd really like to move forward with less litigation and have a settlement that we can all live under. Unfortunately, it seems at this point that really opening the door to additional litigation. And, there's some questions there as far as when is the state going to start regulating our water rights? Is it going to start at the administrative rule or based on the settlement, or are we waiting until we have the circuit court decree? It's not quite clear where that statute directs that. Then there's also some other issues with the litigation that within the agreement it talks about any party can bring forward a complaint based on the settlement, and that doesn't really seem to be curtailing it, but just kind of opening the door for it. There's a number of parties that have concerns with this, not only Water for Life, not only those of us that are upper basin irrigators there in the basin, but also Oregon Cattlemen's has come out and said we'd like to see some further negotiations and can't support it as is. Klamath County Cattlemen's is in the same condition, and the same with Klamath County Farm Bureau. They have some large concerns with it, would like to see revised negotiations that have a settlement that will work for everyone. There's some questions concerning, has it been an open-door process? We just listened to some of the discussion between whether Oregon Water Resource Department has complied with Oregon statute to negotiate on tribal amounts in an open forum. There's also been some question as whether Upper Basin Irrigators, one of the parties that actually have something that we are being told that we're giving up with our water, with a retirement and potentially losing some status within the adjudication. That's a concern. We want to make sure that everybody's voice is heard and that it is an open process, particularly for those that have something to lose in that process. Our water's on the line. We're looking at losing our livelihoods, and we need to make sure that it is an open and fair process that we can all live with. It started as a consensus process, and now it seems to have moved to a majority vote. When we look at a consensus process, we feel that it can be very successful. In a consensus process, everyone gives and everyone gets. In a majority vote, some people get a lot and others lose a lot. So we would like to encourage this to go back to the table under a consensus process. In order to do that, we need time to get that done adequately. We need to make sure that all the parties are actively participating, not just sitting at the table, but actively participating. And we need to make sure there's open lines of communication. We need to have both hearing and listening of all the parties that are at that table. And we really would like to move forward with that under those conditions for consensus management.
Thank you. Appreciate you sharing your thoughts and concerns here today. I think we're going to hear next from Water Watch, and then we can open up for questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DeVoe, and I'm the Executive Director of Water Watch of Oregon. Water Watch has been active in the Klamath Basin for well over a decade on multiple issues throughout the basin. And I think I'd like to start today by saying that the basic problem that we see in the Klamath is that too much water has been promised to too many interests. And until we get the water budget in the basin back into balance with what nature can provide on a sustainable basis, we're going to lurch from conflict to conflict to conflict, and every year one legitimate interest is going to suffer in that basin. We don't see this proposed agreement resolving those issues, and for a number of reasons that I will go through here. If I could begin by just responding to a couple of the questions earlier. The reason there were 26 parties in this negotiation was that those were the parties that had intervened in the FERC relicensing process on Pacific Coast Hydropower Project. I'm not aware of any specific effort to find other parties or to solicit other participation beyond that. Those parties were interveners, and so they were invited to a negotiation. I'm not sure that anyone anticipated that at the beginning of that negotiation that the negotiation would swerve into issues like water for wildlife refuges in the basin or some of these other issues that have come up and been negotiated and proposed for resolution in this proposed document. So I'm not sure there was an effort at the beginning, at the outset, to actually find the parties and invite the parties that might have an interest in some of the resources in the basin to the party. These were just folks who intervened in the FERC process.
Sure. Representative Burley has a quick question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, just did Water Watch intervene in the FERC relicensing process?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, yes. We were interveners.
So if the participants were interveners and you intervened, why weren't you a participant?
I think you're going to hear that.
We were kicked out of the process after, and I'll get to this point. I can address it now if you'd like to. But we have process concerns that I will get to, both the negotiation process and the post-release process, or lack thereof, that we're seeing now that are quite similar to Water for Life's concerns. What happened was this process went along for a while, and then the Bush administration and state of California essentially said, here is a term sheet. You need to agree to this term sheet right now and sign up for this, or the administration will not file the mandatory conditions on the new license for Pacific Coast Project. That's the threat. We said we're happy to continue negotiating in this process to the other end to see if we can come to a resolution that's agreeable. But we cannot sign on to this term sheet because it's very specific in some regards. It's very vague in others. We don't really know what we're signing up for. And so we said we can't sign the term sheet early in the negotiation. We had also raised issues about the federal government setting policy in secret. And that caused issues with who was running the process at the time. The result was the process was dissolved. The federal government stepped aside as the leader of the process, and it was reconvened about an hour later without Water Watch, without another Oregon conservation group, and we were simply disinvited from the process at that point. So that's our perspective on what happened within this, what was supposed to be a consensus-based process, and that's how we were excluded from it. I'd also like to just point out in beginning what this document is. It is a draft settlement proposal only. It's been represented as a settlement, as an agreement. Nobody has signed this document. In fact, the federal government will not be signing this document because it is concerned about this pre-decisional problem that it got into. And there are people and there are groups that are on this, of those 26 groups that are presently signed on to the thing as parties, who will not be signing on to this agreement because they disagree with its terms. So it's been represented as a broad consensus with all these parties agreeing to it, and that's simply not the case at this point. To get into some specifics where we have issues with the agreement, first, this entire negotiation was premised on removal of the four lower dams in Pacific Horse Hydro Project. There is, if you open this document to the page that deals with dam removal, it's a blank page. There is no dam removal agreement, and that, frankly, was the quid pro quo for everything else that happens in this proposed document. There is no agreement, and I confess to you, I don't know what the status is of negotiations with PacifiCorps. Perhaps they will come out with an agreement in principle in a week. Perhaps they never will. But we'll be hearing from PacifiCorps shortly. Maybe they can explain. So the quid pro quo for this entire agreement simply doesn't exist. Second, this agreement will not balance the water budget in the Klamath. The way this agreement works, the Klamath Irrigation Project gets a set allocation of water, and I would like to stress that that would be much more water than is allocated to the project under the current biological opinion for coho salmon in the river. And there are no minimum stream flows for fish or the Klamath River, even in extreme drought years. And so under the modeling that's been done for this agreement, this proposal, we can see stream flows getting well below where they were in 2002 when we had a very large fish kill on the Klamath River. Mm-hmm. Basically, fish and the river get what's left over after the project and other irrigators take their allocation. The river gets what's left. And so it shifts the burden, it shifts all the risk of a failure performance to the fish and the river. We don't believe that's consistent with the law, and we don't believe what's been done in this proposal is consistent with what best available science indicates what is needed for the fish in the river. This is a little bit of a complicated chart, but this is basically the agreement's, the proposal's allocation of water to the Klamath Irrigation Project. What you have here on the left, moving to right, you have predicted inflows of water to Upper Klamath Lake in thousands of acre feet. And on the left, going from bottom to top, you have 1,000 acre foot deliveries to the project at various times. And this was basically from 1961 to 2006. The years that are listed with numbers are actually the years for which there is data under the Klamath Project's current 10-year operating plan. And I would point out that 2005, 2006, 2004, 2003, these years are well below what the allocation, the guaranteed allocation of water to the project that is contemplated in this agreement. And in 05 and 06, we've been operating under an injunction based on the inadequacy of the biological opinion for coho salmon and the Klamath. This proposed agreement would allocate up to almost 70,000 acre feet above what current best available science says coho salmon need in the river, and flows would suffer accordingly. You can also see that as you move from left to right, you have wetter years. And this proposal contemplates giving more water to the project in wetter years than it has really used. As years get wetter, the allocation tends to decrease. But as you can see from the black line on this graph, this agreement contemplates more water for the project than it has almost ever been used in wetter years. There are a couple outliers here. I'm not going to explain those other than this one here. And this is the basis for the statement that the Klamath Irrigation Project is giving up 100,000 acre feet of water under this agreement. Our question there and our comment there is that only depends upon the baseline that you use to make that calculation. If you use a baseline that does not assume the Endangered Species Act operation for coho salmon, that may be the case. But our opinion is that baseline is really no longer relevant because the ESA governs how we have to run the river for fish in the river. And whatever happened before the ESA kicked in and actually started to balance the water budget in the basin, you know, we don't believe it's accurate. It's really relevant to say, well, this party is giving up 100,000 acre-feet of water. First of all, it's an outlier in terms of annual use. And second, it predates regulation based on Endangered Species Act needs. We would suggest the more relevant baseline is 2004, 2005, 2006, once the needs of fish were accounted for. And as you can see, the allocations that would be guaranteed under this proposal are well above what was contemplated in those types of water years. Obviously, in 2002, we had a massive fish kill on the Klamath River. We don't want to see that repeated. And yet, in drought years under this proposal, we would see stream flows in the Klamath that are equal to or below as modeled what happened in 2002 on the river. Next, I would like to move to there are six national wildlife refuges in the Klamath Basin. Two of them have a unique circumstance in the United States. They permit commercial leased land agriculture on national wildlife refuge lands. And there are about 22,000 acres of Lower Klamath and Tule Lake National Wildlife Refuges that are farmed commercially for commercial agriculture through a leasing program. A party that supports this proposal is agreeing to support commercial agriculture on those refuges at current levels for the next 50 years. And we see multiple problems with this, and we are perplexed as to why the state of Oregon would endorse this sort of policy for federal lands on national wildlife refuges in the basin. These are some of the premier wild waterfowl refuges in the nation. 80% of the Pacific Flyway's waterfowl cycle through these refuges in the wetlands of the basin during migration. These are very important refuges, and they have been shrunk and hammered and shrunk again, as I will show in a moment. There are other sorts of provisions in this proposal that are interesting, such as the refuge lease receipts would be funneled into the Bureau of Reclamation to pay off the capital costs of the Klamath Irrigation Project for the benefit of all the irrigators on the project. That's the sort of financial sweetheart deal that we simply can't endorse. These are maps of the historic pre-Klamath irrigation project size of Tule Lake and Lower Klamath Lake, and the brown reflects the amount of irrigated agriculture that existed both pre-project on the left and at present on the right. As you can see, these lakes have been substantially reduced from their historical sizes as irrigated agriculture has expanded substantially in the basin. As far as national wildlife refuge lands and surviving marshes within those lands on these two important refuges, the black here outlines the boundaries of the current those two refuges. The green is pre-irrigation lake and marsh areas in the vicinity of these two refuges, and the gray are the two areas where we have surviving marshes on the refuges. And even those areas, as you will see in a moment, have a very insecure water supply. This is what commercial leaseland farming looks like on our national wildlife refuges. And again, I want to distinguish this from other types of agriculture that happen on national wildlife refuges that may have some substantial wildlife benefit. There is not substantial wildlife benefit from these practices on our two Klamath Basin refuges. Again, 80% of the Pacific Flyway waterfowl go through these refuges at different times of the year. As far as water for the refuges, some folks have said, well, this proposal is a good idea because it guarantees certain waters for the refuges. It is true that this proposal would set a certain allocation for the refuges, but in dry years, those refuges would quickly lose half of their needed water supply to the project. It's simply a transfer of water to the project from the refuges. We don't think that's fair. And in dry years, it would really hammer the refuges. And again, commercial leaseland farming on the refuges would continue to use water even as critical refuge wetlands were drying up on adjacent lands that are within the same refuge. Another issue we see with this proposal is that it contains a groundwater management component whereby the Klamath Irrigation Project would get somewhere between $92 and $97 million to develop a private irrigation and water management plan on the project. And as has been typical throughout this process, there would be very limited public comment or review of this water management plan. We have an issue with managing a public resource in that sort of private way. Essentially, it's a privatization of some public resources here. And we anticipate that there will be a substantial push to move to groundwater as a source through this management plan. As the United States Geological Survey has told us, groundwater and surface water in the Klamath are essentially the same water source. And so if you move your straw from one to the other, it really is taking from the same source. Again, the devil is in the details, and the details of this agreement are fairly complex. But we believe if there is substantial groundwater pumping under this plan, it may well violate Oregon state law. The plan contemplates a 6% reduction in springs and other sources of stream flow in the basin. We don't see how that sort of injury can occur consistent with current Oregon state law. Then we see Endangered Species Act problems with this proposal. Again, as I explained earlier, the risk of a water shortfall is placed on the fish in the river. The proposal includes provisions that would not meet the current biological opinion for coho salmon. And then signatories to the agreement might be required to support amendments to the Endangered Species Act to provide regulatory assurances under this proposal. Folks may have to go to Congress and say, this agreement satisfies the Endangered Species Act. We don't think that's consistent with the law, and we would not endorse that sort of approach. Again, this agreement does not incorporate the best available science that is out there. And it's interesting, in the fall of 2007, the National Research Council came out with a report that endorsed, in part, some of the science that, such as the Hardy Phase 2 flow study, as best available science for the basin. And the stream flows that you would see in the Klamath River under this proposal are substantially below what the Hardy Phase 2 science would suggest is sufficient for fish in the river. There are also electrical power issues. There's a large electrical power rate component to this proposal. Water Watch was one of the parties that litigated in the Oregon Public Utility Commission over the continuance of a very, very low rate for electrical power for Klamath Basin irrigators. The Oregon PUC, in the end, rejected that very low rate, and there was a bill that passed through the legislature that is now ramping Klamath Basin agricultural interests to a standard irrigation power rate over a 7-year ramp. There was a similar proceeding in the California Public Utility Commission, and that commission also agreed that these rates were discriminatory and too low. And California is now ramping irrigators through a 4-year ramp to standard power rates in the Klamath. There's also a provision in this agreement that would wheel federal power from the Columbia Basin to the Klamath Basin. We just think that's the sort of giveaway that we really don't need in this situation. And then finally, we have these process issues that I discussed. Certain groups were excluded, like Water Watch. Others were never invited to the party. And, we would like to ask who designated these representatives to go negotiate in secret and come up with a proposed deal. I think there's a fundamental question here about whether one endorses or not secret negotiations to resolve disputes over public resources. Water Watch would err on the side of an open and transparent process where possible. We also have a very substantial concern about the attempted waiver of scientific and legal standards of the kind Representative Gerard has mentioned, but also others as well. And then we have an issue with the fact that this proposal was released for public comment into a complete void. There is absolutely no coherent post-release public process to take comments respond to those comments and potentially amend what has been proposed here. It's occurring on an ad hoc basis. I mean, Klamath County is having meetings. Siskiyou County is having meetings. We're coming here to this hearing. But there is no federal or state mechanism to take public comments and then have somebody respond to those comments and potentially change the agreement accordingly. So we have serious process concerns about how we got here and where we go from here. There are positive elements to the agreement, or elements that we don't find objectionable. Certainly we would endorse dam removal if and when it becomes a part of the agreement. We have always advocated for a voluntary seller water right retirement program, only limited to folks who want to sell, and this proposal has some of that in it. We also endorse the fish restoration funding and the programs to prepare the Upper Klamath for the return of anadromous fish, and we don't object to the tribal components or the county components in the draft. But we think there are critical problems. As long as we don't balance the water budget in the basin, we are going to be in a continued conflict situation. We don't believe it's appropriate to place the entire risk of a failure on the fish. We don't believe it's appropriate for the next 50 years to lock in commercial leaseland farming on 22,000 acres of our national wildlife refuges. We do not support efforts to amend the Endangered Species Act to weaken it, and we have issues with process and with the power rates portion of this proposal. Appreciate the opportunity to testify today and would be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for any of the panel members here before we call up Pacific Corps and we can hear their perspective? Representative Corr.
Thank you. John, I want you to know how utterly uncomfortable I feel in agreeing with you on a couple of
things. I felt the same way.
It's a new trend here.
Yeah. There, beside the tribe, there were 9 other environmental groups that were part of the settlement. Do you feel they were duped?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Girard. Duped is a pretty strong word.
Here's any word you'd like.
We feel that multiple groups have different interests. We don't believe, you know, I'm trying to read Ms. Brown's notes here.
She can speak if she would like. Lisa, you could go ahead and
prepare. Mine are typed.
Those groups had different interests, and some folks believe that dam removal is the holy grail, and they're willing to trade almost anything away to get to that result. And we don't believe that's the way a negotiation ought to be conducted. So people have different interests, and they're working as hard as they can to get to the goals they support.
One statement. I've been told there is no debt owed by the project irrigators. Do you know of a specific debt that would be eliminated out of if the restoration agreement were to go forward?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Jarre. My understanding is that the proposal is whatever the debt is, it will be forgiven or eliminated. Ms. Brown.
With the record statement. For the record, Lisa Brown with Water Watch. Chair Dingfelder, Rep. Girard. There are two sort of debt relief components in the agreement. One, as Mr. DeVoe just stated, just says we don't know what's owed on the project in terms of past debt, but we will just deem whatever refuge lease land receipts are, you know, existing right now or at the time of enactment of the legislation as equal to that debt. Then there's the second component that Mr. DeVoe's presentation touched on, which is the provision that into the future refuge lease land receipts, about 70-80% of those would go towards paying continuing capital costs of the project.
Ms. Brown, if they don't owe anything, there isn't any debt.
Chair Dean Foster, Rep. Gerard, I don't know the exact number of what they might or might not owe.
Okay.
I understand that those numbers do exist in Bureau of Reclamation offices and haven't seen it, so.
One final question. I would also like to direct this to John. John, doesn't the settlement, in all fairness to the settlement, create and change the purpose of the Klamath project from just irrigation to include refuges and fish and wildlife?
Chair Dinkfelder, Representative Jarre. Yes, in the legislative component of this, it would contemplate changing the purposes of the project to include fish and wildlife, as well as municipal and other sorts of industrial other uses as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence.
Okay. Any other questions for this panel?
I guess I have a comment. I was, Madam Chair, I was expecting more fireworks when you brought up Water for Life and Water Watch to the same panel, but it sounds like they fundamentally agree that the agreement is not to their liking. Did not expect that.
Okay, thank you very much.
I have a comment, Madam Chair, if I could.
I've
been debating on whether or not to do this, and I guess, John, this is an admonishment. You know, your comment about some of these other environmental groups want the dams torn out, no compromise, and give up just about anything. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. But that's the way this process works. You know, it's just like this mosh pit here in the assembly. I mean, you're never going to get everything you want in the bill. Rarely does that happen. And I would submit that if Water Watch cares that much about it, you're going to be a lot better at the table participating than not. And I would also suggest that if you're going to start alleging that there's debts that are going to get paid off and stuff, you need to do your due diligence, do your homework, and get the facts out. Because when you're asked a question, and all you can say is, well, we don't know, but we heard about it, that doesn't do much for your credibility, in my opinion.
Chair Dinkfelder, Representative Burley. I'll let Ms. Brown address this one.
Chair Dinkfelder, Representative Burley. On the capital cost question, as I explained, there are two capital cost questions. What was in Mr. DeVoe's presentation has to do with continuing capital costs, which accrue as time goes on. We don't know what those are, but that is a debt into the future that would be paid off. And as far as being at the table or not, we express our interest to continue at the table, and we were excluded from the talks. So we didn't, just to be clear on that, we did not walk from the talks.
Chair Dinkfelder, Representative Burley, I might add that there's a simple solution to some of these issues, and that's just to say flat out that the agreement will comply with all existing environmental laws. It doesn't do that, and my understanding is there have been other sorts of collaborative attempts to resolve difficult issues where that clause was very problematic because people were not intending to comply with existing laws, and as long as we have these laws, they ought to be complied with. So, if we could have some sort of clause in the agreement that indicated that there would be specific compliance with existing laws, such as the Endangered Species Act, such as Oregon Water Law, and the like, our comfort level would probably go up a little bit.
Okay, we have just a few minutes left, and we had asked PacifiCorp to come and respond to some of the questions about dam removal, and I think they have a few minutes left to do that. Thank you very much, all of you, for sharing your comments here today. And last but not least, PacifiCorp is going to wrap this up for us. Mm-hmm. Sure, we won't have any questions for you.
Hi, Mr. Bowman. Nice bow.
Yeah. For the record, please state your name.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Bolton. I'm Director of Government Affairs for PacifiCorp. PacifiCorp operates in Oregon as Pacific Power, serving more than 530,000 retail customers in the state. We either directly serve or own assets in 31 of Oregon's 36 counties and are Oregon's largest rural power company. I'm here today to provide a voice for Pacific Corp's customers who have a major stake in the outcome of our relicensing efforts currently underway in the Klamath Basin. As you've heard from presenters last week and today, we are currently seeking renewal of a major hydropower asset within our portfolio that produces about 169 megawatts of clean carbon-free power that would provide power to roughly about 70,000 homes or businesses, would be the equivalent of that amount of power. So that the discussion isn't a total abstraction, let me just briefly describe what the Klamath Hydro Project consists of. It's five main stem dams on the Klamath River with seven powerhouses. They work in conjunction with each other to maximize the hydropower capability of that stretch of the Klamath River. And each dam is unique in its engineering and how it operates, and range in vintage from about 100 years old for some facilities to about 60 years old. The project begins at the Iron Gate Dam, which is about 20 miles north of Yreka, California, which is about 190 miles inland from the Pacific Ocean. This is an earthen dam about 173 feet tall and produces about 18 megawatts of power. What's also unique about the Iron Gate Dam is it also hosts a large hatchery operation that Pacific Corp funds, which provides about 25% of the commercial, tribal, and recreational harvest of Chinook salmon that come from the Klamath River. If you go up a few miles, the next major facilities are the Kopco 1 and Kopco 2 dams. These are peaking dams that are rated about 20 megawatts and 27 megawatts, respectively. And then the fourth major dam, located in Oregon, is the J.C. Boyle Dam. If anybody has ever been there, J.C. Boyle is an incredibly unique engineering design, and it produces about 100 megawatts of power from that one facility. And what's really important to note about both the Kopco dams and J.C. Boyle is that these are peaking facilities, so they give us the ability to quickly ramp up or ramp down power on the river to serve our customers and meet their peak load demands. The value of the system is significant to the company and its customers. Hydropower is one of the lowest cost resources available today and becoming more of a scarcity, frankly. This project provides clean, renewable energy without the emission of greenhouse gases, which is, frankly, becoming a premium as we move towards a carbon-constrained world as we look at future imputation of carbon costs into energy prices. And the Klamath dams are also a very key resource for Pacific Corp in shaping our growing renewable generation portfolio to serve our customers. Again, going back to that peaking quality, the ability to back especially our wind resources with hydro power helps shape that to meet our customer demand, and these two resources work very well together. And finally, the value of this system to our customers is also its geographic diversity and location. This is a resource in, frankly, a part of our service territory that does not have major baseload power systems, and so gives us some additional insurance for reliability purposes. In anticipation of the vigorous relicensing process required by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, Pacific Corp convened in 2004 a stakeholder process to explore under what conditions a settlement to relicensing the project could occur under. This effort at settlement should not be confused with the settlement described as the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. As a matter of policy, it's always been Pacific Corp's preference to seek a settlement for a new operating license, and I'll report to this committee today that we are continuing those discussions to try and find a settlement that runs a dual path along our traditional FERC relicensing process. So again, FERC sets out a very vigorous relicensing process that has multi-agency collaboration and stakeholder input. We're continuing through that process, but we're continuing to talk to state and federal government to see if there's the ability to have a settlement that works for all the parties, or at least most of the parties and the company's customers. So we will continue down this path to find the best, frankly, the best deal we can for our customers and the lowest cost alternatives as we look at continuation of this resource. The Clam Basin Restoration Agreement is a document that has grown out of this FERC settlement process, but it seeks to address a whole host of other issues in the Klamath Basin. And while this agreement is predicated on the removal of Pacific Corp's Klamath hydropower assets, it does not contemplate how this would be done or who would pay for it. In Pacific Corp's view, the tie between the restoration agreement and the removal of our dams is political at best. It is not based on any requirements of FERC, and it's certainly not something that the company has been a part of or negotiated. Many of the elements of the restoration agreement have little or nothing to do with the existence of the dams, and even those elements that do deal with habitat restoration in the Klamath Basin can go forward and very likely will go forward regardless of whether some or all of the dams remain in place. We support habitat restoration, and we'll work with all the party to serve these goals of habitat restoration in the basin, but within a framework that recognizes other interests, namely our customer interests, along the way. Pacific Corp has left all options open. We're proceeding with an open mind and through the relicensing process, and we have not foreclosed the possibility that decommissioning some or all of the dams may be the least cost alternative for our customers. But we have maintained from the start that Pacific Corp's requirements are that our property rights must be respected and that our customers must be made whole and protected from unreasonable costs, the loss of a carbon-free emitting power resource, and the potential of unlimited legal liability that could attend what could be the largest removal of dams in U.S. history. Very significant undertaking being contemplated within the agreement. So while we recognize that much of the discussion of potential resolution, many of the Klamath Basin issues, began with us through the FERC relicensing process, we also recognize they do not end with us or this FERC process. Regardless of whether there is support within the Klamath community or within states of California and state of Oregon for the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, Pacific Corp will continue to move forward with the federal process laid out before it as required by law, and we will continue to look for the best outcomes we can for our customers as we pursue our obligation to provide affordable and reliable power. You know, as the committee has heard, this is definitely an emotional and complicated nest of issues that the restoration agreement and the FERC process has raised to your attention. And we understand the significant work that's happened within the 26-party group to try and find some common ground, and we respect that very much. And I want the committee to understand Pacific Corp is not some absentee landlord in this discussion. We are proud to be the electricity service provider for the Klamath Basin, and we're also a key part of that community. We have numerous employees who live and work in the Klamath Basin who care deeply about the basin's future. Our company's been around for almost 100 years. We hope to be around for another 100. And certainly the long-term sustainability of the outcome of the situation in Klamath is definitely in our best interest. So with that, I'd tie it off there and make myself available for any questions you may have.
Thank you, Scott. Any questions? I'm going to close up the information. Representative
Cannon. Thank you, Madam Chair. Scott, under what hypothetical conditions would dam removal become a lowest cost option for Pacific Corp? Would that be threat of litigation for not removing them? I mean, what conditions would prevail that you alluded to making that sort of the right business decision?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, as we go through the FERC relicensing process, state and federal agencies will provide prescriptions for what the conditions of the new license would entail. And so those conditions can range from habitat restoration or fish passage requirements to what the new flow regime will be under the license agreement, and so forth. And so each one of these factors will change the economics of operating the dams. There's no doubt that the cost of the power that we receive from the Klamath project today will be much cheaper than what it will be in the future. The question for us as we go through the process and try to understand and work through the different conditions will be how much more cost will be added as we go through that. And so we will be in the position of evaluating what those costs are and, you know, pegging that against what, you know, the alternatives of market power will be.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and Scott, thanks for coming today and filling us in on this. I want to, for my colleagues on the committee and others, I mean, I think, Scott, you touched on a few things that I absolutely agree with, and that is that hydropower is cheap, clean, and renewable. And obviously the concern about the impact of the ratepayers is very important, and I think that that needs to be very prominent in this discussion about tearing these dams out. But I also want to call everybody's opinion, and I think we might have the opportunity later this summer to actually have a field trip looking at some of this. That other IOU, the Brand X one here in Oregon, that also went through FERC relicensing on the Pelton Round Butte complex, they were able to work a way out to deal with reintroducing fish above those dams, and that's what I hope to be able to show the committee this year when we go out and look at Whiches Creek outside of Sister. So I only bring that up because it can be done, it has been done, and, you know, I just think that, as you said, this would be probably the largest dam removal project. It certainly is to my knowledge. I don't think the Elwha, is it Elwha, Elway Dam, Elwha, is anywhere near as big as any of these, so... I don't envy you, but I do thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Scott? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate you coming. And with that, we will close the informational meeting on the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. Colleague, tomorrow is our last committee meeting. It's at 1:30, and we are going to hear from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I've asked them to come talk about the relisting of the coastal pongo. Very important issue, and then we have a presentation on carbon footprint reduction through design. Next stakeholder, Metro Council, will be here. So two very important issues, and our guests are welcome to come back if you're interested in these issues. Thank you.
Thank you.
That'll close the House Committee on Energy and Environment. Mm-hmm.